I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's monthly Current Science Forum series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. What is pain? Why does it exist? Does it serve a useful purpose physiologically in evolution? And just how does it work? What are the functional processes that are in force? When they say it's all in your head, well, in the case of pain, of course, that's pretty much true. And some of the processes that are involved with pain, as we've come to understand them, are also involved in other important physiological perceptions, such as our ability to detect poisonous materials or spoiled food or a wide variety of other noxious substances or stimuli. This is a phenomenon known as nociception, and without it, we could not survive. It's a fascinating area of intense research activity right now, and of course, as with so many other research endeavors, we have one of its prime practitioners right here in the Triangle. So here to discuss all of this and share his latest important research findings with us on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Wolfgang Liedtke from Duke University Medical Center. Wolfgang is an assistant professor of medicine and of biology in the Department of Medicine's Neurology Division. He is also the director of the Center for Translational Neuroscience at Duke. He received his MD from the University of Cologne in 1989, and his PhD in Clinical Medical Sciences and Medical Virology from the University of Bochum, also in Germany, in 1990. He has been a member of the faculty at Duke since 2004. Wolfgang, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Glad to be here, Ernie.
Just yesterday, this is a big week for you, I know, you published a major paper in Environmental Health Perspectives, the monthly journal of the NIEHS, on how exposure to diesel exhaust particles contained in air pollution cause damaging effects in the lungs of susceptible people. Now, we're going to tie this in with your longer research agenda in terms of pain and nociception in a while, but this is an important paper, so I wanted to get you to tell us more about these findings and why they're so significant.
Well, I'm very glad to be here to be able to explain the findings, and you are right, it is indeed a major paper, and I'm very happy about it seeing the light of day and becoming part of the public good through publication in the NIEHS journal, where it is freely available for viewing and download. Mm-hmm. So the most important findings in this paper are that epithelial cells, which are cells that are lining the airways of humans, and maybe making a little bit of a sophisticated distinction between airways and lungs. So we are talking about more of the upper airways.
Okay.
Tracheobronchial tree, trachea, and also nasal passageways. And these airways, air conducting ways, until the gas exchange is happening inside the lung. These air conducting passageways are lined by a unique type of cell that is a very specialized, has a very specialized function in, you know, optimally conducting the air to where it's supposed to go. And air is, well, that's the air we breathe, we need to live, but air can also contain substances that are not advantageous to the organism, and therefore over evolution systems have evolved that make it, that make these cells also participate in detecting stimuli or detecting cues from the outside world that are not as advantageous to the organism and respond in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have discovered is that a pollution agent and part of particulate matter air pollution, diesel exhaust particles, particles generated by combustion engines that function according to the diesel principle, that these particles are a noxious stimulus for these cells and that they evoke a unique signaling cascade, or very specific signaling cascade in these cells that has cell surface receptors, specific cell surface receptors that are dedicated to specific cell signaling, and that these signaling pathways are activated by the diesel exhaust particles. And we identify a number of these cell surface receptors, and with that we identify very likely the beginning of this signaling. If you examine airway cells in response to diesel exhaust particles, many things are happening, and this has been done since a while by many very competent people, including here in this area, NIEHS and EPA researchers. They are very, very good at that over the years.
Right.
And
they have labs right here at UNC, right?
UNC and the EPA has the UNC campus and the campus in the RTP.
Sure.
They're very, very good at that, and they have documented changes in these cells for many years, and these changes are important. Yet, how are these changes starting? What is the primary switch that the pollution agent is switching from off to on, so that these cascades start rolling, and that then we detect the intracellular changes that have been subject of study for so many years.
And these changes ultimately lead to disease, right?
They lead to disease. For example, cancer of the airways, or chronic airway diseases like chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases, development of lung emphysema, and we can get to the diseases in a little while.
Sure.
But I think our findings highlight a prime switch, how the pollution can switch on certain signaling cascades that are not for the good, not for the good of the cell and not for the good of the organism. So we identify receptors that are involved. And in the first place, we identify a receptor that goes by the name of PAR2, P-A-R-2, PAR2 proteinase activated receptor 2. So it has been described as a receptor that is activated by proteinase, meaning proteolytic activity, protein cleaving activity. Mm-hmm. Proteinase activated receptor 2 was initially identified as the receptor for trypsin. So trypsin out of the pancreas can cleave PAR2 and activate it in a similar manner like...
And this is tied with disease as well, is it not?
It is. Trypsin, the trypsin receptor PAR2 has been linked to allergic airway diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So there we already have a clue, a tie-in to a relevant disease process, namely the implication of PAR2 being part of allergic airway disease signaling.
Sure.
So we see that PAR2 is activated by diesel exhaust particles. We then identify signaling from the PAR2 receptor, which is a G protein coupled receptor, a 7 transmembrane receptor, to an ion channel. and I spare the intermediaries of that, even though they are very interesting. But the next big hub for the signaling is an ion channel named TRPV4. And that's an abbreviation for transient receptor potential vanilloid 4. It's
you got it right.
We can. Well, I got it right because I found it, and it was published a decade ago in a paper in Cell, and that was work done by myself and Stefan Heller at the time at the Rockefeller University in New York City. That is a very, very big discovery that I'm still immensely proud of, and that I now notice has spawned an entire field of people looking into the function of TRPV4. I'm one of them because I had my hands on it for more than a decade, and I won't let loose. So TRPV4 is activated via activation of PAR2 by diesel exhaust particles. Then what does TRPV4 do? TRPV4 is an ion channel. So ion channels are very simply said functioning like valves, where they hold tight and shut. But if you press the right lever, they let in an incredible amount of whatever it is, air, or in the case of an ion channel, ions, from one side of the cell to the other side. And a TRPV4 channel typically lets in ions from the outside of the cell to the inside, and it is particularly suited to conducting ions that are positive, such as sodium, potassium, and calcium. And it has a slight preference towards conducting calcium favorably. And it is believed that the calcium influx through TRPV4, that is the critical switch for things to happen inside the cell, as calcium is a very, not a universal coin, but a very powerful and a very dedicated intracellular switch signaling molecule. TRPV4 is a calcium permeable channel, and that means that diesel particle exposure of airway epithelial cells leads to influx of calcium. And now, calcium influx can be good and physiological, but our study suggests that the calcium influx into the human airway epithelia is not physiological, but is just too much. Just inappropriate. And that there are things happening in response to this calcium influx that are not right. And we pick one particular measure of outcome that is detrimental, and we build on previous work, is a detrimental production of collagenase or MMP1 by the airway epithelial cell. And that is a molecule that can essentially liquefy extracellular matrix or liquefy cells.
Okay.
It is a liquefying enzyme, collagenase. It cleaves collagen and also goes by the name of matrix metalloproteinase 1.
So very destructive.
It's a destructive thing and a destructive extracellular protease, and it is uniquely primate. So MMP1 has no match in a rodent genome, mouse, rat. You can find it in human, you can find it in chimpanzee, gorilla, etc., but it is not present in animals that we oftentimes work with, mouse, rat. So MMP1 is a collagen lytic and other proteolytic activity. It's secreted by the cell, and we know from airway and lung disease that MMP1 is an enhancer of the formation of emphysema, and that MMP1 is also a strong catalyst for development of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
COPD.
COPD, and we can go into these diseases a little furthermore.
Sure.
Even though I'm not a pulmonologist, I'm a neurologist and a clinical neuroscientist by training, but I think I know at least a little bit about those diseases to speak to it. COPD is a top 10 disease according to the WHO in terms of worldwide health impact.
Right.
But they have a very sophisticated measure of death, suffering, economic impact on the society where it occurs, etc. And COPD is right there. I think number 6, number 7, but it's a top 10 disease in terms of impact.
Yeah, it's a major disease.
It's a major disease, and COPD is enhanced through MMP1 in airways and lungs. That's a fact we build on, and that is what we demonstrate, that the calcium influx through the TRPV4 ion channel in response to the exposure to pollution, and that inappropriate and heightened or elevated production of MMP1, that is the outcome. And here comes our first exclamation mark, is identification of a human genetic polymorphism, so a human genetic predisposition to respond in a certain way, mm-hmm. where some people make not much MMP1 in response to diesel particles, and others make a lot. So you have only like the low-end responder, the moderate responder, and the other one we can call the turbocharged responder. Mm-hmm. And the reality with that is that 75% of humans all across the world are turbocharged. 25% are moderate, and if you view MMP1 only as detrimental, which is not true, because otherwise it would have disappeared over evolution,
sure.
Then it comes to the fact that 75% of people are more in danger when exposed to particulate matter. 25% of the people are more protected if they were exposed to such an environment.
Which explains, to a great extent, the differences in disease rates in polluted areas.
Yeah, that is a very interesting phenomenon. We know that exposure to aerogenic pollution is not leading to a uniform degree to the same type of damages. And there are people who are excessively vulnerable to breathing polluted air. Mm-hmm. There are also people, for example, that are very vulnerable to smoking, while others are almost like resistant to the effects of these.
Sure. And that's also based on production of the same protein.
So one issue of that is MMP1 production, and we have taken advantage of a previously identified genetic switch in the so-called promoter of MMP1, mm-hmm. Where there is either a single guanidine nucleotide or a double guanidine nucleotide at a certain position in the DNA regulatory region of MMP1. And if you have 2G, you're turbocharged. If you have 1G, you're protected. So we use this polymorphism throughout the study, and it's just pervasive and very consistent to see that the 1G polymorphism, the response is blunted, and with the 2G polymorphism, response is very much elevated.
I see.
So that is number one genetic factor that we identify and clearly exhaust in depth throughout the experimental series. Second factor that we identify, and that I find very exciting from the standpoint of ion channel biology, TRPV4 biology, is a variant of the TRPV4 ion channel. Then TRPV4 ion channel has about 800 amino acids, so it's a relatively large protein. It's a protein that is, of course, anchored in the cell membrane because it needs to conduct ions. So it's not a protein that's in the cell's nucleus or in the cytoplasm, but it's a transmembrane protein,
sure,
to do its job. So 800 amino acid, and a large chunk of the protein is intracellular, so directly underneath the cell membrane, both in the beginning of the protein as well as at the end of the protein. So at the beginning of the protein, there is a 19th amino acid, which happens to be proline, and that is just, we know that from the human genome. And there is a variant in humans, a genetic variant, where proline at position amino acid 19 is replaced with serine. And these are quite different amino acids, and people have been wondering about this switch from proline to serine at 19 of TRPV4, because the polymorphism where 19 is serine leads to a susceptibility of humans to develop COPD.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So the mm-hmm. human geneticists have been interested in this question that we just discussed, that mm-hmm. Some people are more hardy and some people are more vulnerable to air pollution, mm-hmm. and they have been going at it in a more systematic manner.
Sure.
And with all the tools of 21st century human genetics that there are. And as one result, a colleague from GSK in the Research Triangle Park, who has since moved to New Jersey, Dr. Srikumar Pillai, then of GlaxoSmithKline, identified a human genetic polymorphism that predisposes humans to develop COPD, that is TRPV4P19S. That was published in a human genetics paper, mm-hmm. and it was a very profound and a very thorough paper. Pillai is a great expert in his field, and that's a paper that has no holds. But it is a human genetics paper, and it does not explain what this TRPV4P19S does at a cellular level or at an organismal level, so that humans become more readily ill with COPD. So our paper is that. It provides the link.
Provide that mechanistic.
Mechanistic insight, what happens, and we propose that it is the human airway epithelial cell in which TRPV4 P19S acts, and we identify, we have clear evidence that the P19S variant of TRPV4 is a gain of function channel. It means if you go back to the valve analogy, that, you know, if you press the lever, then more air or more molecules per time pass through the channel. Mm-hmm. And we provide the proof for that using two type of complementary techniques, which is visualizing the calcium coming into the cell and also using electrophysiology, which is measuring bioelectricity across membranes. Both of these techniques that we have brought in, they show that the P19S channel is a gain of function channel, is a hyperfunctioning channel in response to air pollution. And we also show that it is not only the calcium that goes up that is possibly amped up by 100% or is double the amount of the normal variant. We also conclusively show that calcium is used by the cell to switch on MMP1 to that 200% level.
That's the turbocharge.
That's the turbo. So then we have the two genetic variants feeding each other or going hand in hand. Where you have P19S is a turbocharger of TRPV4, and MMP1, the two guanidine polymorphism in the promoter, that's a turbocharger for MMP1.
Mm-hmm. And that's what leads to the adverse outcomes.
So the worst outcome would be to have a 2G polymorphism in MMP1 and to have a 19S variant of TRPV4. If you do that, you get an amount of MMP1 that is made that no other condition reaches.
I see. Yeah. Now, these experiments that led to these results, was this all in vitro work?
This is result with human epithelial cells that were provided by our colleague, esteemed colleague Andrew Gill from the Environmental Protection Agency, who has his lab here in Chapel Hill. He expertly prepares and provides human tracheobronchial epithelial cells from volunteers, where people are donating their cells for Dr. Gill's research, and he collaborated with us throughout and provided us with these cells.
I see.
So you can call it in vitro. I would call it a bronchus in a dish.
Okay.
Yeah, because these cells are become cultured directly from humans, and they differentiate in the dish the way that Dr. Gill cultures them, which is pretty tricky and pretty not for the beginner in cell biology. And so we just relied on him providing them, and we, you know, become pretty expert at using them.
Sure.
But he made them, and he provided them to us.
I see. Well, that's fascinating, because I know that work has received a lot of attention, the lung in a dish.
It does. Concept. It does. It's a lung in a dish, and we have a pathway that, as I mentioned, is primate-specific. So therefore, trying to go to the organismal level is not as straightforward as just taking a mouse or taking a rat and then trying to follow through with that animal what might be happening.
And you said the rodents really didn't have a good model for this, right?
The rodents don't have a good model for that because, they cannot model MMP1 because MMP1 is not present in their genomes.
We
could engineer rodents that become humanized
in
this terms, but that is not just, that goes beyond the simple measure of bringing in this organism to ratify the findings.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the particles themselves. I understand that they are diesel exhaust nanoparticles, and that you've been able to actually analyze them and determine their component parts and construction.
A little bit. So, coming from a medical corner about that and not being an environmental scientist by training, I have taken my wisdom and my have experienced a great learning experience again with collaborators in this study. And that is, in first place, Dr. Sidney Simon from Duke University Medical Center, who has a long-standing interest in the field of, you know, particle biology and particles interaction with nerve cells and with respiratory cells. He has done great work on that over the years and influenced me greatly when coming to Duke University first more than 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there's Dr. Summer. Then there's also Dr. Ian Gilmour of the Environmental Protection Agency, who's one of the world's experts on diesel exhaust particles. So if he were here, he could give you a more profound more detailed answer to that.
I guess where I was.
But to go back to your question, nanoparticle mm-hmm. is defined through the size. In the diesel exhaust particle, the elementary diesel exhaust particle is a nanoparticle because it's smaller than mm-hmm. the 100 nanometer diameter that you would request according to this definition. And it is purely carbonaceous. So it's a core of carbon that is at its core, and it's not perfectly round. It could rather be visualized more like a sponge or okay. an uneven mm-hmm. surface, so that it is a nanoparticle with an incredibly large surface, all of carbon. And then with that incredible large surface coming out of the combustion process of the diesel engine, it is coated. It is mm-hmm. avidly absorbing many things that it encounters. And the first thing it encounters is during the combustion process in the engine. So it is coated with organic chemicals. It is also coated with inorganic chemicals such as metals. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have just taken the first steps into what in the diesel exhaust particle is an active principle for the signaling cascade that we observe. And the bottom line result of that is it's the organic chemicals that are coating the nanoparticle that retains the activity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a very complex construction. And I know that one of the great challenges in environmental health work right now is the idea of mixtures, that there are, these completely unpredictable mixtures of compounds in air pollution and things like that.
Well, this is a complex mixture that is generated by the technical process of burning diesel the way a diesel engine operates, namely at the pressure above 20 bar, mm-hmm. without a spark plug, just by pressurizing the air diesel fuel mix and making it explode inside the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That leads to the generation of these small particles coated with these organic chemicals that ultimately come from mineral oil, from diesel fuel that is burned at these temperatures, at these pressures.
Sure. Well, it's remarkable that you've been able to kind of narrow it down such as you have and really characterize what's going on at the
cellular level. Yeah, we have narrowed it to something like a number of chemicals between 4,000 and 5,000, according to mm-hmm. Dr. Gilmour and also Dr. Cho, who did these isolations herself then at the EPA. So it's a mixture of 4,000 to 5,000. You can call it a tox library, where, a toxicological library rather than a chemical library. And ultimately, we would like to know, which of these 4,000 to 5,000 chemicals is an active principle, mm-hmm. or is it mm-hmm. maybe a combination, like an oligo of several 5 or 6 that really exert the punch in doing this, and the other 4,995 are not that active.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have plenty of work to do still.
There is some really interesting follow-up work to be done that comes out of our study, yes.
Wolfgang, what about the potential clinical implications of these findings you've been describing? Given that, as you say, 75% of us are apparently genetically susceptible to the phenomenon you've described, is there a way to develop a therapy that might prevent that type of damage from occurring or reverse it once it has occurred?
Well, we discuss it in our paper, and that is a concept that I have run by collaborators. Then as soon as we saw the first round of findings that implied TRPV4 and other surface receptors, so the idea that we propose and tender is to use aerogenic inhibitors or modulators of these molecules, where, as I said, all of the signaling steps that we identified are membrane proximal. They're bound to the membrane. They are on the surface of the cell, mm-hmm. and
so they're accessible to therapy.
They're accessible to the outside world. They are right there where the air that we breathe meets the first cell. And not only is membrane and outside, but the lung epithelia have a very characteristic, unique, and beautiful structure where their top area where they face the air is ciliated. Mm-hmm. So they have small cilia.
These little hair-like
the little structures. Hair-like structures. Mm-hmm. And those hair-like structures, they are beating. They are motile. And they are not beating chaotically, but they are beating in a coordinated manner, sure. Which is a fascinating physiology, but it is also of great medical relevance because that has to function in order to clear, in order to provide so-called mucociliary clearance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mucociliary clearance is an important feature of a healthy airway that clears itself and renews itself from repeated environmental exposure of just like dust.
Sure.
Or inhaled ashes. They are being cleared by or cold air that leads to enhanced production of mucus, and the mucus is cleared by mucociliary clearance of these lung epithelial cells. So
that's the process that's disturbed in a disease like cystic fibrosis, right?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Or when it's also disturbed in COPD,
sure.
Where COPD mm-hmm. goes along in the more chronic phases with a de-differentiation of the epithelia, where the ciliary beat function is impaired.
Mm-hmm.
So our work shows that the entire signaling cascade that we demonstrate is located to the cilia of these cells. So it's not just that we say, hey, it's there, and this is the way it functions, and this is your P19S turbocharge, etc. But we also locate it to the cilia, to the very top of the cell that is exposed to the air.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in this respect, we not only provide a novel function to what human tracheobronchial and upper airway epithelia, what they can do, but also we have a subcellular location of it. It's a ciliary function. And the cilia are not just, quotation marks, stupid brush-like things that just move things. They also are sophisticated detection machines. In this respect, I think our study dovetails beautifully. It was a recent study by Dr. Walsh's group from the University of Iowa, and that was quite in the headlines, where Dr. Walsh showed that bitter taste receptors, so receptors that have been shown to detect taste in the mouth, that bitter taste receptors are expressed in cilia of human respiratory epithelia, and that functions, and he suspects that it has to do with a sentinel function of the cilia to detect things that activate bitter taste receptors.
Mm-hmm.
And bitter taste mm-hmm. receptors, essentially, that's not good. That's something to stay away from. It's an alarm signal.
Sure.
And he makes the case that certain bacteria can secrete products that activate bitter taste receptors. So it's a sentinel against a bacterial infection.
Mm-hmm.
So our study goes to point out that, you know, this is a relevant environmental pollution, and the relevant environmental pollution activates, in the first place, PAR2, the proteinase activator receptor 2. So proteinase activator receptor 2 can also be activated by bacterial proteases. So bacteria make protein-cleaving enzymes mm-hmm. that activate mm-hmm. specifically PAR2, that has been shown. And then there are also non-bacterial invaders, such as certain mites and certain, you know, insects or, of that species, bigger species, multicellular organism that can invade an airway, parasites, multicellular parasites that make enzymes that can activate specifically PAR2. And so this is another sentinel function mm-hmm, that goes mm-hmm. via PAR2 that has previously been mentioned in the context of allergic diseases.
Right.
So we have a nice molecular route for that. And then we say that essentially the air pollution that comes from human ingenuity or lack of ingenuity is hijacking this pathway that has evolved over millions of years to protect the organism.
So it's a protective pathway.
Exactly.
But the air pollution is
hijacking it, and therefore there has not been enough time mm-hmm. for, you know, creatures to develop an evolutionary countermeasure.
Right. Maybe so then, 10 million years will be all right, but not right,
right.
now.
But there comes the
climate change will have wiped us out by then anyway. Yeah, so
that's right. But the therapeutic implication, coming back to it,
sure.
comes in that we say, well, we can, just the same way that the air pollution hijacks these signaling molecules, because they are all on the surface and they are all on the cilia, so then these diesel particles, they can just wipe themselves clean. They can just unload this organic dirt that is sticking to them onto the cilia and onto the surface receptors. just like that, we can also take the same route and apply drugs and just shut it off. Mm-hmm. So the diesel mm-hmm. particle would, you know, unload, do its thing and be the Trojan horse, delivering this poisonous organic chemicals to the membrane of the ciliary, of the cilia, mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. respiratory epithelia. But like that, we could just shut that down and an easy and facile way, without systemic toxicity, without gastrointestinal exposure, hepatic metabolism, exposure of the CNS, etc., would be the inhalatory route.
Okay.
And inhalatory route, I'd like to give two examples that are pretty common to many people.
Sure.
One is inhalation of corticosteroids mm-hmm. is being used for upper airways as nasal inhalers, for allergic airway diseases, for chronic sinusitis, where you want to reduce the swelling of the mucous membranes.
Sure.
People inhale corticosteroids as nasal inhaler or as a deeper airway lung inhalers for asthma.
Right.
And other mm-hmm. Lung diseases where, for example, permeability of the alveolar filter is impaired, cortisone is inhaled mm-hmm. deep into the lung.
So
inhalatory therapy.
Use the same route,
route
of exposure for the drug.
And exchange the corticosteroid problem. Against a more specific inhibitor, and essentially all of the identified signaling molecule would be obvious candidates mm-hmm. to be targeted.
Are there compounds out there in an inhalant form that are inhibitors, MMP1 inhibitors, for example?
They are not out there as inhaled compounds. One could ask whether inhaled steroids have that function, mm-hmm. whether there is, you know, of the pleiotropic effects of steroids, whether they would also in some sort of way act on these signaling cascades. Mm-hmm. That would be a question. But I'd rather not target MMP1 because MMP1 is made by the cell and is secreted at the bottom end of the cell into the organism.
Okay.
I target those PAR2, phospholipase C, TRPV4 at the top of the cell.
Sure.
We would need to use a TRPV4 blocker to mm-hmm. block the influx of calcium through TRPV4. And just shut down the calcium. If you shut down calcium, the MMP1 would not be switched on.
Right, the cascade.
The cascade is just incapacitated mm-hmm. through disabling the calcium influx. That's a very attractive target because influx of calcium, that's like the common target or the common pathway at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You could also target PAR2 and say PAR2 is a, in quotation mark, diesel receptor, diesel exhaust particle receptor, and mm-hmm. just disable PAR2. See what happens. Maybe that would be effective. That is a possibility. And finally, these intermediaries between the G-protein coupled receptor and the TRP channel, that is the phospholipase C, the PI3 kinase, and the G-protein GIGO. We have inhibited those in our experiments, and that would also be an attractive possibility. For example, given the efficiency of phospholipase C inhibition, that is a complete wipeout mm-hmm. of anything mm-hmm. that we have looked at. It's very, very efficient, and those molecules are out there. They have not been used for systemically because of systemic toxicity issues. But again, if you inhale, you don't have systemic toxicity issues.
So do you anticipate that this will find its way into at least clinical trials at some point?
I'd hope so, and I'd be moderately optimistic that the answer mm-hmm. to that is yes.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you just published this week, so obviously it's early days yet.
Yeah, ours has translational impact and has translational bearing, but it's not a translational study. And it is done with human primary cells. So we're pretty close, and we are, you know, between translational and basic science, and definitely have a leg in the translational arena. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's very exciting and definitely going to be worth keeping an eye on as things move forward.
Well, regarding the translational, I would just like to throw in one modifier and slight correction.
Sure.
Going back to the beginning of the show where you introduced me as a director of the Center for Translational Neuroscience, that's not correct. That's Dr. James Namara. James McNamara is the director of the Center for Translational Neuroscience, together with Dr. Warren Strittmatter, who are two senior people at Duke. I was one of the first hires into this center.
I see.
And so
I stand corrected, and I'm glad you did that. Well, I try to give people promotions, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And my guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Wolfgang Liedtke of Duke University Medical Center, Department of Neurology. And we have been discussing his work on air pollution and lung damage. And this is all new work. And Wolfgang, I wanted to ask you, how does this work, which is highly significant, tie in with the rest of your research agenda on pain and pain perception and nociception?
Yeah, it ties in very well for my understanding, and I hope I can make that plausible to listeners. Well, maybe as one qualifier, it ties in with the fact that I have first described TRPV4 10, 11 years ago, and this is another facet of TRPV4 where you could say, well, this is a chapter in the book of TRPV4, and it has a headline or title of How TRPV4 Makes Humans Ill, Roman 1.
Mm-hmm.
So this is that Roman 1, and believe me, I'm not idle. I want to add more chapters to that, sure. And there are more diseases that are being caused by changes, variants, and mutations in TRPV4. So there are things ahead in terms of TRPV4, and I have to admit I have a feeling of adhesion to that molecule and really, you know, just feel enthusiasm about finding out what TRPV4 does in physiology and in disease. And the story is not over, not at all. So that's my TRPV4, my heart beating for TRPV4. But more in a systematic manner, how does research on lung on airway epithelial cells tie in with understanding pain pathways? I try to understand pain in a specific way that I want to probe sensory transduction. And sensory transduction is the process whereby an external or an internal cue of some physical physical or chemical manner leads to the perception and sensation of pain in a human. So the transduction is the very beginning of it. And transduction involves external or internal cues that are just not yet biological.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is some biology that translates them into a language that ultimately the nervous system can understand.
Right.
So my focus is also on seeing that interface between the physical cue or the chemical cue, like acidity or osmolarity, which is osmolarity a chemical cue? I think it's rather a physical cue.
I'm sorry, what is that?
Osmolarity is the sum of all osmolites in a watery solution. Like salts are major osmolites. Sodium chloride is a major osmolite in the external fluid of the mammalian vertebrate bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But then with osmolarity, you would also have to add the oncotic pressure of proteins. So proteins can also act like salts in being negatively charged, or some proteins positively charged.
Mm-hmm.
So the sum of all these osmolites, that is osmolarity.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Osmolarity is very, very important for life. And a TRPV4 has been identified as a channel that responds to changes in osmolarity. So there is my, you know, my osmolarity thing, and wanting to understand how can osmolarity lead to sensory changes, sensory transactions, and pain. Osmolarity changes leading to pain are reflected in the Bible, where there is an Old Testament quote of to rub salt into one's wound, which enhances the pain. And that is enhancing the osmolarity, enhances wound pain. So I want to go to the very beginning of how the sensory transduction process goes, and I want to not be blindfolded and disregard other cells and other part of the body that are part in this that are not nervous tissue. For example, skin is very important for pain perception, such as in, you know, superficial skin injury, skin inflammation, skin cuts, sunburn, chemical irritation of skin leads to skin inflammation. And in an area of inflamed skin, we have decreased thresholds for pain stimuli. So I want to not lose sight of the peripheral feeder, the non-nervous tissue feeder and the non-nervous tissue partner of the neuron, of the nerve cell that is doing the transduction and that is conveying this information into the nervous system, into the spinal cord, into the brainstem, and ultimately into the cortex to make pain aware and to give pain an emotional connotation and make it as horrible as it is or as it can be.
Sure.
So airways epithelial cells are very, very strongly innervated. That is a concept and an idea that Dr. Simon and I share. And, you know, for us, it's just a no-brainer. But it is, well, fortunately, unfortunately, in the research community of the airway world, it's a little bit of a niche or under-researched or underappreciated in terms of output of most papers, where that particular feature of airways is not the subject of most research papers.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that is a view that Dr. Simon and I share, where we see that the epithelial cell is strongly innervated by a sensory neuron, and a sensory neuron.
So this is a classic example of multidisciplinary work yielding important results.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't think that as a clinical neuroscientist, a neurobiologist, that one, or I want to include those non-nervous partners and feeders and interactors.
Mm-hmm. So the epithelial cells are one example of
that. One example of that.
Out of many.
Yes. And one other example, to give you an example, is another collaboration I'm having at Duke University with Dr. Farshid Gulak of the Orthopedics Research Department, who is an extremely well-known person in the world of joint biology and joint function and malfunction, and the particular cellular player he focuses on the chondrocyte and that make cartilage. That's his area of study. So Dr. Gulak and I work together, and we try to understand chondrocyte biology, where I'm coming in from this particular angle that I have just described.
Mm-hmm.
And the clinical reality, the clinical match with that is that, well, there's an unfortunate reality of joint pain.
Which in people that suffer it can be quite excruciating.
Where, joints are normally not innervated to cause us pain. They just have proprioceptive input, position of the joint, etc. But then if a joint wears down or another pathologic circumstance, it can hurt incredibly. And that also has to do with, a pathological maladaption of the nervous system to a situation, to a local situation in a joint. And I don't want to lose sight of what is happening at that area where the cartilage is being destroyed and the chondrocytes are becoming something different than they have been at birth or during young adulthood. And I want to understand how these chondrocytes talk to the sensory neurons so that in the end there is joint pain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'll bet TRPV4 has something to do with it.
Well, that is what Dr. Gulak and I have betted some money on, and so far our results make us get up in the morning and want to do more.
Indeed. Well, speaking of that feeling, Wolfgang, I know that you are also, as a physician scientist, you are also a clinician and have a clinic.
Yes,
I'm dedicated to people with
right.
pain.
I'm part of the Duke Clinics for Pain and Palliative Care, mm-hmm. which is a joint venture between several departments, clinical departments at Duke University. I think the biggest player in that is the Department of Anesthesiology. So I'm there as a neurologist.
Okay.
Part
mm-hmm.
of the pain clinics as a neurologist is we are three neurologists in the Duke Pain Clinics. I think half a dozen anesthesiologists or almost 10 anesthesiologists. And my particular job or my particular outpatient clinics is for people who suffer from trigeminal pain.
Yeah, what is trigeminal pain?
Well, trigeminal nerve is essentially the sensory the sensory nerve and the sensory neurons for the head and face and all adjacent structures like eyeball, nose, sinus, teeth, mm-hmm. Tongue, inside the mouth, surface of the face, part of the surface of the head, is also innervating the dura, which is the membranous covering of the inside of the skull. So dura makes essentially every form of headache a trigeminal pain.
I see.
Now, that is a very, very common pain disorder, and in this respect, I don't have the capacity to handle migraine patients and to handle headache patients, because it's just too many, and that is in the realm and in the territory of my colleagues who do that.
Mm-hmm,
so
sure.
I have to say trigeminal pain minus migraine and other forms of headache, which are trigeminal pain by that definition. Trigeminal pain in the reality is trigeminal neuralgia and so-called trigeminal neuropathic pain or atypical face pain, what is being referred to. Both these forms of pain are very, very, very bad forms of pain and very horrible forms of pain in terms they go to the limit of what humans suffer and what humans can suffer.
Sure.
If unmitigated and untreated. And indeed, just an over-the-thumb survey of my clinics yielded that neuropathic pain and neuralgia pain is about 50-50 in the patients who come to see me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So does this population actually serve, patient population that is, kind of serve as a ready-made cohort for your research pursuits? Are you able to kind of recruit them to provide samples and things like that?
I am moving along research efforts to do clinical research, do human research with the patient cohort of my clinics. I have ideas how to marry or how to closely intertwine the bench work in my laboratory with work with patients, but that has not yet reached the projecting, has not left the projecting stage at this point.
Mm-hmm.
My patients give me great inspiration to think about the research and to ask certain particular questions that we pursue at the bench in the laboratory. And on the other hand, my bench work and work with cells and animals and with colleagues, discussions, being part of the scientific community gives me also a unique perspective to hear the specific complaints and the specific problems and issues that my patients encounter with their pain, and also to ask them specific questions that I guess I'm not part of the routine drill in a pain clinic where a patient goes. So I think my pain clinics, it is demanding and it is also exhausting to do this.
I imagine.
But it is also that there are also moments when it works, or we make some progress and we make somebody's life a little more manageable from this horrible form of pain. It's incredibly rewarding. And I think I have now seen a number of people, or enough patients, to say that I have a feeling that my rate of making some progress for some is not that bad. Because that doing pain medicine is an incredibly frustrating business.
I'm sure.
And fortunately, it's not a major health issue in terms of numbers, right, but it is a major health issue in terms of impact.
Absolutely.
Because people with those disorders are devastated. Their lives are devastated to destroyed. They're sometimes getting closer to doing something to themselves. And it is an incredible level of destruction or an incredible level of stress in general to the family and social surroundings of such patients.
I'm sure, as you mentioned, it must be quite rewarding and motivating to continue with your lab, your bench research, because, you know, in characterizing the process that's taking place at the molecular level, as you've described, there are potential therapeutic or preventive even implications. So that must, as you say, keep getting you up in the morning.
It does, yes.
That's pretty cool. Wolfgang, we've just got a few minutes left, and I did not want to let you go without asking you about one more piece of your research.
Uh-huh.
About that you and your team recently published some very interesting work about the profound change that occurs in neurons at birth when the infant switches from amniotic fluid to breathing air.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about that work?
This is work on the regulation of chloride inside neurons, and that plugs into pain because neurons dysregulate chloride as a cause for improper activity in pain circuits. So in the way that pain is conducted, or normal pain is conducted, has a certain order and a certain physiology to it. And if chloride along these cables or along these routes, if chloride inside the nerve cells that do this business of routing the information, if that chloride is too high inside the cell, they become super sensitive. And they can make like something out of nothing. They can conduct an impulse in response to a stimulus that would normally never ever be conducted.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been implied in the pathophysiology of pathological pain, namely so-called allodynia, which is, you know, if you being touched or if there is even no stimulus, is being sensed as pain. That is allodynia. So allodynia could be underwritten by chloride dysregulation in neurons in the pain pathway. So we try to understand this phenomenon at the basic level, and we resorted to the so-called perinatal chloride switch, because that is the fundamental process that you want to go at first. We are also now trying to investigate whether the same mechanisms that we have discovered for the chloride switch in newborn vertebrates, it's not only in human where a chloride shift is happening, or in mice where a chloride shift is happening, it's across vertebrate phyla, and it even looks like that it happens in C. elegans.
Roundworm
model organism, they have 300 neurons and 1,000 right. cells. Mm-hmm. So even in those guys, they do a chloride switch as it recently appeared. But in mammals and in vertebrates, it's very, very firm. So mm-hmm. we went to that chloride switch and tried to understand that at the fundamental level, at the basic level. And those are the results of that, how this gene is regulated, the gene that pumps chloride out of the neuron, that makes chloride go from high to low. How is the what is the gene switch for that? And we found a novel gene switch for that. That is the paper that we published in November of 2009 by Michel Yeo and Ken Berglund, and then also the George Augustine, who has since left Duke University, mm-hmm. published that paper. And now we're looking at how this plays out in pain or in pathological pain, whether similar mechanisms are operative in a non-developmental situation, but rather in a pathological situation where we estimate, well, is a pathological situation maybe a reversal of healthy development, and that has been a good idea for a number of attempts to understand diseases, and so we are taking that route to understand pain or pathological pain.
Well, and I think that next time we have you back, you'll probably have some important findings in that arena, because that does sound like a very fertile territory.
It is, yes.
Well, Wolfgang, thanks so much. We are virtually out of time. And
thank you very much.
It's been a wonderful hour.
Great being here.
And we will certainly keep an eye on your work. It's fascinating and important.
Thank you very much.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo, and you can always check the website, RadioInVivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. And we are also on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan, and you can stay up to date by doing so and checking that page every so often. Please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. And a great way to do that is to log on right now to the WCOM website, WCOMFM.org, click on the Donate Now button, and get the details on how to make a small monthly contribution and join our Less Than a Latte Club. For less than the cost of just one latte per week, you can help keep this independent voice of the community on the air, and I just signed up for Less Than a Latte, and I've got my bumper sticker and everything, so you'll check it out. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.